Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Gabino Iglesias. He is the author of the new novel, The Devil Takes You Home. Gabino is a writer, journalist, professor, and literary critic living in Austin, Texas. He is also the author of the critically acclaimed and award-winning novels Zero Saints and Coyote Songs. And Gabino, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you very much, Hopeton. Thanks for having me. Stoked to be here.
Well, I'm really excited to have you on the show. Our mutual friend, Scott Montgomery, is a huge fan of your work. And so I'm just really excited to have you here. Finally, I get a chance to interview Gabino Iglesias, who Scott has been talking to about for years. He's actually, is he your PR agent? Because he really promotes your work, Gabino.
No, I think he, you know, he's been doing his bookseller thing for many, many, many years. And I've known him since before my first book came out. So he's seen the struggle. He's seen all the almost 12, 13, 14 years with indie presses. Book People was one of those very few independent bookstores in the entire country that carried some of my indie work from smaller presses. And yeah, I've known him forever. And this was sort of the when I got my galleys, I got in my car and I drove down to Book People, and the first galley that I gave anyone, you know, hand to hand was to Scott as a thank you. Like, listen, man, you put up with me for so many years, but I finally did something that's going to be on your shelves, without you having to interfere. It's a bigger press, and, it feels nice to, do events with him now and know that he's been such a supporter from day one. So shout out to Scott.
Absolutely. So tell us what The Devil Takes You Home is all about.
Devil Takes You Home is a funny, romantic, middle grade book. no, it's not. It's a young father whose very young daughter contracts leukemia, who, like a lot of things in the world, is a racist disease who kills brown babies at a higher rate than anybody else. And in this country, when you get a lot of medical bills, you tend to get desperate because we don't have the best healthcare system in the world. It's incredibly expensive. So, you know, daughter gets really sick and things go south. And when all of that compounds together, he loses his job at an insurance agency, at a life insurance agency. He's broke. He's desperate. He wants to do everything in his power to get outside of that situation. And, you know, when people get desperate, they do desperate things. We do bad things for all the right reasons. And so that leads him into a life of petty crime that very quickly escalates into killing people, and then eventually trying to land that one big job, which is stealing a couple million dollars from a cartel that's just sold some meth in the United States and is bringing the money back to Mexico. And then things also don't go his way when that starts to happen. So it's basically a book about things not going his way. Yeah, and then along the way, he I guess it sort of becomes a rote novel, a road trip novel. And he spent a lot of time with two other characters, the guy who sort of brought him into the job and the guy who has all the knowledge, because at one point he worked for the cartels. And each one of these characters has an agenda. There's their own personal reasons why they're doing this, and those are not necessarily things that walk hand in hand. And some supernatural mayhem ensues, and a lot of people die, and that's about it.
Yeah, they have a pretty good body count there. So what was the inspiration? Was it the dark side of your thoughts that was the inspiration for this novel, sort of this nihilistic view of the world?
I got a little bit of help because I had the idea for, you know, a desperate dad, because I had sort of been there slightly a couple of times in my life. And then I probably wrote maybe 35,000 words of this novel while teaching MFA classes at Southern Hampshire University's online MFA program. I was a full-time high school teacher at Idea Montopolis here in Austin. I was teaching four different preps for all high school grades, 9 through 12. I was a floater. I didn't have a room. So it was a very time consuming type of thing. And so I was writing, you know, in 15 to 30 minute increments during my lunch. I would type with one hand while eating a sandwich. And, then 2020 rolled around and the pandemic showed up and they said, we don't know how we're going to translate some of your classes. Cause I was teaching, a lot of weird classes, a lot of electives. I was teaching things like, you know, ethnic studies and a research AP class called AP Research. And, you know, I was teaching journalism. So they didn't know where it was going to fit. So I didn't have a contract. So I was unemployed, severely underpaid, and suddenly found myself without insurance as the pandemic was raging. And we didn't have vaccines back then. So every morning I would check out the news and I would read, you know, old man from Houston contracts COVID, is left with $450,000 medical bill. And that was enough to keep me home for a couple of weeks. Like, I didn't want to go outside and catch anything. And that grief, that desperation, that sort of like, what am I going to do now? No one's hiring. When you lose your job normally under normal circumstances, it needs to be very, very much about you. Like, you know, I lost my job. And when it happened this time, it was sort of like, I lost my job. Everybody lost their job. Everybody's losing their jobs. All the folks in the service industry are probably losing their jobs faster than I did. And maybe they weren't, you know, they probably didn't have the best insurance to begin with. So
let me jump in here real quick. So you were leaning into the reality of life in a COVID economy where you're just out there with no support. And I will also say you have leaned into structural inequities and structural racism in this novel.
It's when you have a name like mine and you send that one out with the resumes, you already understand that you're at a disadvantage. So I was born in Puerto Rico, born and raised, fully bilingual. You know, I started teaching myself English when I was 10, and I would go to the, you know, job interviews, and I would get asked, like, do you need someone to sponsor you to work in the U.S.? So I would get that via email. I would get that interview on the phone, and they would ask the same question. And as you know, over the years, that stuff kind of builds up and to go out and punch racists. So you can do it in your fiction. It's therapeutic and you stay out of prison. So I did a lot of that with this book. It was like everything that I was worried about, everything that made me angry, went into the book, and then I didn't have to carry it around all day.
Well, I appreciate your candor about this because so many writers do draw on their personal experiences when writing these books, though there isn't a one-to-one relationship. I know one of the things writers hate to hear is that character based on you? And then you're like, well, parts of my personality, not none of the bad stuff, but a little bit of my personality. So what are your thoughts about that? Because that is something that writers often get asked. I remember I interviewed a writer once, and I asked him how much of the novel was based on his experience, because this writer went to Harvard. The book was set at Harvard. This writer played basketball. The protagonist played basketball. I'm not going to tell you what he said, but I was like, oh, come on now.
No, I think every single character that we create is sort of a mix of everyone that we've ever known. We grab bits and pieces of how they behave, how they talk, how they dress, how they walk, you know, whatever they look like. And then we put that into our characters. And in this novel, particularly when I was writing the main character, I had sort of, you know, things that worried me that I was angry about. And I created a character for that. And then in the process of writing that character, my life started emulating what the character was going through. And I was
wait, so you're saying it started emulating the character after you started writing the novel, not before?
After I had three jobs when I started writing this novel. So I was not losing any sleep. I had a good health insurance. I knew where my money was going to come from to pay my rent. And then when I started writing his story, and then slowly the pieces of his life.
Is there some sort of supernatural tie there, Gabino? Because, you know, you failed the power of positive thinking there.
Yes, I know. I'm going to write about really happy millionaires next time. See what happens. We'll see how that goes.
Well, this was a great introduction to me, to your work, because our mutual friend Scott Montgomery, bookseller, book people always talked about your horror work and how impressive it was with the writing you did in that genre. And I don't read a lot of horror. When I was in my 20s, actually, I read a lot of Stephen King back in the day. But you take this supernatural element, you mix it in with some mystery, and one of the things I thought this novel was really about throughout the book was suffering, and how do you deal with suffering and pain from the circumstances of your life? Because this character Mario, the protagonist, no matter what, throughout the entire book, he never forgets his wife, right. He never forgets his child. That is something, that thought that is always on his mind throughout the plot, right, of the book. Is it difficult to write about suffering and pain, that the kind that Mario was facing?
I think the hard part for me is leaving it all behind. Like, it's easy for me when I'm feeling something to get into it. So I'll close the windows and I'll put on some dark music and I'll tap into that. And then you don't want to stay there. Like, you want to enjoy some good music and eat a cookie and talk to your friends and laugh and give your mom a call and tell her that you love her and all that good stuff. The writing itself is not hard for me. It's like, once I'm done with a chapter and I know I have to go do something else, it's pulling myself away from that and just walking around and being a normal person, knowing that none of the things that exist in this world that I talked about are going to be solved at any time soon. Like, we're not going to stop racism because we finally address it in fiction. We're not going to change the face of publishing because now we have, you know, write more writers of color and more writers of the LGBTQ community and more disabled writers. It doesn't mean we've achieved equity finally. None of that stuff's going to go away. You know, the Supreme Court's going to still be there doing its thing, and we're going to still be fighting for equal rights. Just kind of to pull myself away and just be a normal person and enjoy a movie and don't stay angry all day, because life's too short to spend it completely angry every single day of the week.
So Mario's mother is Puerto Rican. His father is Mexican. His mother was a drug addict. And so when you look at the circumstances of Brian, who's a white boy in the novel, and if you look at it, and correct me if I mispronounce his name, is it Wonka?
Wonka, yeah.
Wonka. All the three main characters are just coming out of some really, really hard familial circumstances that sort of affect the trajectory of their lives. And I think sometimes in general, when you see a lot of criticism of what's happening in brown and black communities without the backstory of the structural racism and structural inequities and all the suffering that they're coming from, they're not coming from, you know, picket fences, porches, pools. Talk a bit about building that backstory that provides sort of a canvas for people to really understand why these characters do what they do.
I've been hearing about, non-intentionally racist things my entire life. Like, you're going to write and you're going to write in Spanish. That's great. Sadly, you know, brown folks, bilingual folks in the U.S. don't read that much. And then if you call them out on things like that, they will tell you like, well, it's because they're always working. It's because, you know, they don't have time for that. They're raising kids. And so they try to pull back that slight little bit of racism the reason we see so much black crime is because there are so many black absent fathers. And then you call them out on that. And it's sort of like, well, yeah, there might be some reason why, you know, it's not the prison system. It's not, you know, racist cops, none of that. It's just like maybe just black folks are just more prone to crime. And then you start hearing all these things and you're like, all right, let me just try to address this in a different way. Each one of these characters has a different life. They come from different places, but you have to understand the psychogeography of your characters. Where are you coming from? What did your parents do? And in many cases, what did they live through that made them the way that they were? It's not that your parents didn't want to go to college. My parents didn't go to college. It's not they didn't want to. They couldn't, right? In some cases, it's like, you know, my dad was trying to provide and he got caught with like half an ounce of weed and then life crumbled. While if he had been, you know, in a debate team in college and he might have been a white guy in a very expensive car, he could have gotten caught and they would have given him a tap on the hand, and please don't do that again, and send him on his merry way. And we see those things every single day. So when you create these characters, even though you don't write the entire biography of each one of these characters, you have to let the readers know these are not bad folks. Like, people are the way they are because their positionality comes from somewhere. It comes from their education or lack thereof. So if you're going to talk about education, what opportunities did they get? Could they afford it? What were the schools like, you know, wherever they were born? Were they going to school in like Manhattan, or were they trying to go to public school in like rural Alabama? You know, these things have an impact on each one of those characters. If I don't build that, then I'm just creating these characters who might be perceived as bad for no particular reason. Like, you know, they're just, it's a border kid, a white guy from Austin, and a dude who used to sell insurance trying to get a lot of money from a cartel. And that could make, I don't know, maybe it could make for an entertaining story, but it wouldn't have, you know, it wouldn't have reasons for each one of them to be the way that they are. And I always like to give those reasons.
When you build those characters, do you write sort of a separate backstory that you pull from to put into the novel, or is it sort of organically part of the story and then you sort of edit what you need to keep in and what you need to take out?
I don't write it down. I'm a pantser, but I think a lot of folks hear that term and they think we go in unprepared. Like, you know, you're completely unprepared to do this thing because you don't have a plan of action. And I think they're forgetting the amount of mental work that goes into a novel before we actually sit down and do this thing. So we're probably the only folks in the business of listening to the voices in our head all day long. So before I start writing these characters, I've had several meals with them. We've shared more than one beer. I know what music they like. I know their sexual orientation, their philosophy, their religion, their family history. And I don't want to write each and every one of those details down, because then you'd end up with 900 pages of, you know, their familial history. And that's boring. But I draw from that, from knowing them profoundly, the way that they speak, what they think, how they feel about things. Writing a novel is basically taking it as, you know, X amount of characters and exposing them to certain stimuli. And I know that sometimes we're surprised by that, but in the meantime, we shouldn't. Like, most of the time, we shouldn't be surprised. We put them through the ringer and we kind of know how they're going to react, because they're like our children. We created them from the start, and we should know how they're going to react to things.
Well, surprisingly, because I know over the years, and I've been doing these author interviews for 13 years, some of the authors say it's organic. And of course, authors do an incredible amount of preparation, whether you literally write it down or not. You're always thinking about these characters. You're thinking about where you want to go with the novel. But some of them have talked about just once they finish thinking about it, they just start writing. And they just let it flow. And then I run across authors who say, okay, I wrote a complete outline. I have to write an outline. So sort of a function of who you are, because writers approach it differently, but either way, being successful.
Yeah. Find what works for you.
So you talked a bit about the character being from Puerto Rico, and we get some great, what I would call just some great cultural history of Puerto Rico that you put into this novel. I'm half Jamaican. My father immigrated from Jamaica in 1949. And so I'm always interested in sort of that Caribbean perspective and sort of that mosaic that makes up people coming from Puerto Rico, their backgrounds, or makes up people coming from Jamaica. And there's a point in the book where a character tells Mario that Nigerians have been stolen from their land and brought to the island by the Spaniards. He said their anger still lived in our veins, that we were a mix of evil conquistador blood, Taino Indian blood, and African slave blood. So immediately I run to the internet and start saying, okay, I'm a little bit familiar with that history, but I said, wow, I didn't know Nigerians have been brought to Puerto Rico. So talk a little bit about how you input into this novel some of this incredible cultural heritage that of the people from Puerto Rico.
One of the reasons why I was mostly forced to start addressing racism when I moved to the U.S. is because it wasn't much of a big deal back home. Because, you know, when you're from an island in the Caribbean, no one's really that white. And if they are, then you only consider them white because they're in some kind of color spectrum, because everyone's kind of like something mixed. We know that in the center of the island, really high up in the mountains, you will find really pale Puerto Ricans with like green and blue eyes, because some of the Europeans that moved to the country realized up in the mountains it was a little bit cooler and they needed some of that cool air to not die from the heat. So they traveled up. We know that places like Loíza in the coast, you will find entire towns that are mostly black, because escaped slaves would cross rivers and set up, you know, small shanty towns near the beach and near rivers and places where they could get food and also kind of, you know, vanish real quick if someone was coming to get them. And I think Puerto Ricans now sort of have this. We were told things when we went to school. We were told of the Spaniards came and they slaughtered Indians. And you grow up and you start reading other things and then you realize, no, they didn't. They killed a whole bunch of them. But it's like the same story we were told as Puerto Ricans. Folks came to the United States and killed all the Native Americans. No, they not. Their culture is alive. The Native American tribes, most of them are still alive and you know, a part of this country today. So for us as Puerto Ricans, it's mostly about, let's address the fact that we had a dark, you know, bad history. The Taínos were there. They were sort of living in a primitive state while, you know, Europe had art and literature and all these other things. The conquistadores came. They were not the best people. They didn't send their best representatives. When it came the time came to build the country, they went to Africa and stole a whole bunch of Africans and brought them here and said, now you have to do all this work and build an entire country for free or die trying. In the end, we are a mix of, you know, we have our DNA split in three, and we have to address each one of those, you know, and give them the respect that they deserve. And that's why we have bomba en plena music. That's why we have, you know, African food like mofongo and gandinga and, you know, all these words that we use regularly. And I want to bring that into my work, because I think the moment you move away from home becomes that much more big and important in your life, like holding on to the things that you used to know. I kind of wanted to explore a little bit of we say Puerto Rican, and we picture one or two things. We picture either small islands 100 miles long by 35 miles wide, or we picture New Yorkans, like Puerto Ricans in New York, being loud and happy and, you know, always in a party and having music and being really proud of their culture and heritage. But there's a mix in there. There's like, we need to address a lot of things. We need to talk about, we grow up and if someone claims whiteness in Puerto Rico, we say, tu abuela donde está, which translates to like, where's your grandma? Like, we don't allow anybody to claim whiteness because show me your grandma. You're not. You need to accept what your DNA carries. You need to accept that conquistador blood and that African blood as well. So it's fun to write about it.
And I really love the road trip aspect of this novel. It starts off in Austin, by the way. Do you believe that there are too many hipsters and too many damn festivals in Austin nowadays?
I think so. It's festival season. The fact that it has its own season, is it winter? No, it's festival season. Just stay away from downtown those days. Yeah. Too much.
But talk about that drive from, because you could have chosen to not cover the actual drive from Austin to San Antonio to El Paso to Juarez. Talk about putting that drive together in the novel, that the characters, Brian, who is, as you said earlier, the guy that recruited Mario initially to do petty crimes and then become a hitman. Juanca, who has the big idea of stealing from the cartel with support from Don Vasquez. And of course, Mario, talk about putting together in the novel that road trip.
I just mentioned 35 miles wide by 100 miles long. You can't drive back home more than 2 hours without dropping into the ocean. Texas is not like that. you can drive. I've driven from Austin to Amarillo, and that's what, basically 10 hours and you never leave the state. So when we say Texas is big, we mean Texas is big. So it's easy for us to talk about Dallas, Houston, San Antonio, Austin, these big cities with a lot of people and very diverse cultures. But then there's other places. And like, if you go from Austin, you drive an hour and you go to San Antonio, it's kind of like Austin. Sure, you have some music, you have some tacos. It's different. It's not exactly the same thing. And Austin, I used to teach ESL classes to undocumented workers for 2 years, but Austin is not necessarily the border. Like, if you go down to El Paso, you experience a different culture. Everything looks different. It sounds different. And I've done that drive a couple times. And, we think of those cities like inside Texas. But when you drive from one to the other, you really see the rest of the state. And it was important to me to talk about, that chunk of miles between Austin and El Paso, where it seems, and I think I put that line in the novel, it seems that God took the same mile of arid desert and just copy and pasted the scene.
By the way, I have driven it twice.
So you look
I
out
know, the window, but you can go 90 miles an hour on I-10. Won't you get?
Yes, and it's a lot of nothing. There's a lot of blue sky and brown ground for miles and miles and miles and miles. And I wanted to give that sense of space, because when we read noir, it's about space. It's like, noir is about New York City. Noir novels are like about LA. And if I was going to bring that down here, let me talk to you about our spaces and the heat and the desert and the mountains and the flatness, put that into the novel to give it a sense of space. Like, make sure when you read it, I wanted to make sure you didn't think it was like Chicago or like Boston or Miami. It takes place here, and it's very here.
One of the interesting things you do in the novel is sort of this integration of religion, some elements, I believe, of Yoruba.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, people don't know that sort of, when you look at the history of Christianity, sometimes they integrated elements of other religious cultures into Christianity to persuade the people to support it. I remember reading a book about Cuba and how the African population there, when they were being forced to bring in Catholicism, and how they would do certain things to sort of integrate part of the Yoruba religion into Catholicism. So talk a little bit about how, because what you do in this novel is, and I went to a Catholic college, so I had to take 6 hours of theology, 6 hours of philosophy, Xavier University of Louisiana. But you sort of give what I think is this very interesting take on how it can be utilized by even, you know, Don Vasquez and right. some of the other supernatural elements that sort of take off elements of Catholicism and Christianity, but sort of reveal how some of those elements actually come from other religions.
Yeah, no, it's the and you mentioned Jamaica before. Guaguan. It's Jamaica, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Haiti. Historically, we brought these people in, and we said, this is going to be your new religion. And they said, no, Jack, in order for me to go on about my business, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take, in the case of Yoruba, like, I'm going to take my old gods, Ochun, Yemaya, Elegua, Chango, and I'm going to dress them like you dress your saints. And you're going to be sure that I'm doing exactly what you told me to do. But hell, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to keep my culture intact. I'm just going to dress it up like it's Halloween, and it's going to look quote normal from the outside, because you want me to be the way that you are. And that led to the Caribbean islands becoming sort of the epicenter of syncretism on an international level. Like, we got, if you name it, we got it. Santeria, Vudu, Palo Mayombe, all of the smaller Yoruba religions. It's wonderful. And then when you move away, you realize you grew up immersed in it, so you never really saw it till you moved away. And then you realize, well, you could have a normal, quote unquote, normal neighborhood, and you could have the Christians living next to, like, the Jews, and then the Jews were next to the Rastafarians, and the Rastafarians lived next door to the Yoruba folks. And we didn't fight about it. It was like, hey, whatever your grandma does, it's fine by me, because she feeds me and we love your grandma. So if you pray to, you know, our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, that's fine. If she slaughters a couple of chickens and puts, you know, photographs in water overnight outside the house, that's also fine, because, you know, it's whatever. And then when I wrote Cyril Saints in 2015, I was studying how some of that spread. And then you get Candomblé in Brazil, and you get how it happened in other places. And at the time, I was obsessed with Santa Muerte, with Holy Death, and how that had taken its own shape. And now there's like 9 million people across the world praying to Holy Death. And I've been doing that for 3 books now. Like, I love exploring the way that we took certain things and made it special, made it ours. And then the rest of the world sort of sees it as very weird, where if you go to the Caribbean islands, it's normal. It's your neighbors. It's what they practice. And, you know, if it works for you, if it keeps you mellow and it makes you happy and it doesn't tell you to do bad things, why not?
Talk about the arc of the character Mario, and where do you see he has gone, without, of course, revealing the end? So I'm asking you to do it, because I don't want to mistakenly say something you don't want me to say.
You can say whatever you want to say. I think
I don't want to reveal the plot. You authors, you crime fiction novelists, don't want that plot revealed.
Right. Spoilers. We don't want spoilers, I guess.
Right.
I think he starts out thinking there's a lot of hope, and he starts trying to do the right thing. And when given the opportunity to make a lot of money, he gets a little bit clouded. He gets a little bit confused, and, you know, he starts dreaming, I'm going to move away from the darkness and the evilness of the things that I'm doing by thinking I'm going to get my wife back. We're going to get a new beginning. I might be able to move to another place where my daughter's ghost doesn't haunt me. We can get the American dream. We can get the beautiful home with the white picket fence and a little labradoodle playing in the backyard and 2.5 beautiful children. We can get that if I do everything that I must do to get this job done. And towards the end, he's still trying to do that. He's like, I'm going to try to take care of Brian's baby in some way. I'm going to spread the wealth. I'm going to share my money. He's always driven to do the right thing, but sometimes trying to do your best, it's not enough. Like, you should have thought about your consequences and some of the things that were going to come from your actions. as you were doing them. And when you're in the middle of a problem, you might shoot the wrong person. You might go down the wrong road, and then you realize a little too late. So I think he's all of us. Like, you know, we get flustered, we get confused, we make bad decisions. I know I do it all the time. But I think he's a good guy at heart, and he was really hurt, and he was trying to, you know, find a new life, find a new reason to keep going, to find enough money to go do something else.
He still had hope, and that's one of the things I really liked about the character. No matter how bad things got, he still held on to the hope.
Right.
With the thought of making things better, recognizing certain things shouldn't be happening. He didn't lose his consciousness. He didn't completely lose his moral center. He recognized that definitely not a sociopath at all. Definitely not.
No.
So poverty. You really get into some big social issues in this novel here. So I'm starting to think, does he have a master's in sociology here?
No,
I don't. But let me quote you on poverty. And you're actually saying something I agree with. You said a lot of things I agree with. That's why I like this book, because you just said a lot of things I agreed with.
Thank you.
But I was entertained, actually. I'm joking. I'm not joking about that, but I was actually entertained. So what people with money don't understand is that most poor people's problems can be solved with money. Right. There are problems that won't go away no matter how many bills you throw at them. But for people like me, this is Mario speaking or thinking, for folks whose nightmares have names like hunger and eviction, money is a wonderful thing that can make tribulations disappear in a matter of seconds.
Yeah. In 2008, when I moved here, it was an adventure. It was awesome. I'm going to go there. I'm going to try it out. Within 2 weeks of moving here, I had landed a job as a TA at UT Austin. I thought it was going to work out. You know, I was going to get my degree, and it was going to be kind of fine. I started signing my life away. Like, yes, give me. I need some money. So please give me some student loans so I can make sure that I can stay here and pay my rent and do all of that. End result of that was, you move here, you have. You have to pay your deposit. You have to pay the first month. You have to pay the last month of rent. You have to buy furniture. You have to do a lot of things. So the day that I arrived in Austin, I think I had like $236 to my name. And being a TA at UT Austin at the time paid me $930 a month. So then it starts getting tricky. It's like, how do I get a little bit more money? So I started freelancing. And a lot of things happened after I was done being a TA. You know, I worked, I taught ESL classes. I graded essays for Pearson at night. I sold life insurance. I was a journalist. I've done everything. And it seems like you build and you build and you build, and then something might happen. Like suddenly your car breaks down, and then for some reason you get fired. And then suddenly, you know, 30 days go by and you're like, I'm out of money. Like, I can't sleep because I'm out of money. Like, I have no insurance. I don't know where my rent's going to come from. And it's really hard to focus on something else. Like, for every parent in the world, it's like, I know at some point my kids are going to get sick, right? If I have $10 million in the bank to fly them somewhere or to get them the best medical care, if I can buy my mom insulin, if I can pay for my auntie's, you know, cancer treatment, you don't think about those things because you're already solving them. If you're not worried about where the money's going to come from to do all the things that you need to do, you focus on other things. So sometimes we're like, oh, so-and-so is always so angry and he's always on the hustle, always looking for that dollar. People don't like living like that. It's being forced to live like that. And we don't like to talk about poverty because we like to think that this is a land of opportunity. You know, there's a lot of people struggling. There's a lot of people who can't put meals on the table. As someone who worked at a public school, we kept feeding the kids during vacations and during during Christmas and during spring break, because they wouldn't get those meals at home if they're not getting them from the school. So you're talking at that level. Like, if we don't feed you, you don't eat. And that's not supposed to happen in an advanced rich country, because this is a very rich country. So I like to talk about those things. I know you mentioned entertainment. I want to entertain. There's a lot of gun action and running around and weird creatures, but
yeah,
you know, if I can talk about poverty, racism while we're doing that, then I feel like it means a little bit more than just weird underground creatures and you know, magic and child mutilation.
Wow. Yeah, see, I didn't reveal that.
Yeah.
So the last thing I want to talk about, and this is my own term, I know it's really backstory, but I love the storytelling within the storytelling.
All right.
And the way, you know, we learn Brian's story, we learn Mario's story, we learn Wonka's story. Just a storytelling within the storytelling. Talk about making those stories vibrant within the story.
I think we, at some point, we start thinking about writing as a series of elements. And I know this because I have it very present, because I teach creative writing. And so we talk about writing, and we talk about character development. We talk about economy of language, and we talk about dialogue, and we talk about world building, and we talk about pacing. And I think a lot of writers forget it's storytelling. This, you become a writer because you want to be part of the wonderful, you know, storytelling tradition of humans. And it starts around the fire. Like, tell me a story. And then it all, for most of us, it also starts in our own lives with, like, hey, grandma, tell me a story. And then they tell you a story. And I think we lose that when we start to focus solely on the other elements that we understand as writing. So when I go in, I do want to tell my story. I want it to be the kind of thing that when I send it to an agent or an editor, they say, like, all right, this kid can write, so we might publish this. But what I care about is, like, is this something that would capture attention if we sat down together to share a coffee in the morning? And I'm like, man, let me tell you about my friend. And then I start telling you their story. Are you going to yawn and check your phone, or are you going to pay attention because it's something that you understand what's happening? It's gripping. You find yourself sort of pulled into these character stories. So I tend to forget about all the important writing elements. And then when I'm writing, I go first for storytelling. Am I telling something that's going to touch somebody's soul? Is it going to be entertaining? Is it going to be scary? Is it going to be sad? Am I communicating grief properly? And so I focus on that first. I care more about the storytelling, and then I'll tackle, you know, this is a misplaced comma. Let me get it out of there. This is a misplaced word. I'll do all of that editing later after I think that I've nailed. Like every time someone writes to me and they go, like, you know, I couldn't keep reading after this chapter, or you made me cry. I'm like, yes, that's what I care about. I told you a story that touched your soul. So that's the storytelling. That's not the writing. It's the storytelling. And that matters more to me than anything else.
So what's next for Gabino Iglesias?
More mayhem. The next one is done. I'm done with the storytelling part of the next one. Now we make it make it good. We try to make it good. we sit down, we do a lot of editing, and within the next 2 to 3 weeks, it'll hopefully be with my editor, Josh Kendall at Mulholland Books. And hopefully he loves it and he takes it, and then on we go. We do the whole thing all over again.
Is it a mix of genres again? Can I ask that much?
Yes, it's what I do. It takes place back home. It's five friends. One of them, this is based on reality. I had a friend in high school whose mom was shot in the face twice, working the door at a club. And at the time, I knew this is the beginning of a very powerful story. And through the years, I always thought about what could have been, the things that we could have done that we didn't do because we were scared, the things that we could have done. And we tried and we didn't pull it off. But I never thought I had the storytelling chops to tackle something like that. And then the way that The Devil Takes You Home was received by a lot of readers made me believe in myself. Like, I can finally tell this story. So it's more crime and more grief and more horror. With, instead of underground creatures, we have something living, outside the reef, because it takes place in Puerto Rico. So there's something living beyond the reef, and a lot of mayhem. And I talked to my agent and I said, this is, I'm sorry, but this is a little bit sadder than The Devil Takes You Home. And she was like, you cannot tell me that. I was like, I'm sorry, it's the way it turned out. It's a little bit sadder, a little bit darker. So hopefully people will go with me.
Gabino Iglesias, author of The Devil Takes You Home, the summer picks of the month for Crime Fiction Picks of the Month, is Scott Montgomery.
Thank you.
Book People, myself, and Amanda Moore. And we pulled Molly Odense in there from crimereads.com. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for doing this, because diversity matters.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.